The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway this morning, where the big story comes from the Times of Israel. The Israeli Defense Force is ready to conquer Gaza's Rafah City. It awaits the government's okay, says a senior official. Reading from the story, the Israeli Defense Forces has conducted all necessary preparations to take Gaza's southernmost city of Rafah and can launch an operation the moment it gets government approval, a senior IDF official said Wednesday. Israel deems Rafah the last Hamas bastion in Gaza Strip and is poised to evacuate Palestinian citizens from there and assault Hamas holdouts, the unnamed official told Reuters news agency, which didn't specify whether the source was connected to the IDF. A spokesperson for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government told the agency that Israel, quote, was moving ahead with the ground operation but gave no timeline. Meanwhile, multiple Israeli reports indicated that top Israeli security officials visited Egypt yesterday to coordinate the planned offensive in Rafah. It's happening finally. Also, IDF deployed two reserve brigades to Gaza as Israel girds for the Rafah offensive. We also got a video, a hostage video, from Hirsch yesterday. Goldberg Poland, Hirsch Goldberg Poland, talked for 3 minutes. It's torture, right? It's torture. It's against the Geneva Convention, but we're dealing with terrorists. The parents, God bless them, pray for Hirsch, pray for the parents, responded that they're, hold on, Hirsch, not that the Hamas people are going to let Hirsch know what's going on. And we had Mike Johnson go up to Columbia, and very successful visit. Now, meanwhile, it's spreading across campuses. Dozens have been arrested at the University of Texas. Incredibly, dozens have been arrested at USC near the library. They never go near the library at USC, so I don't know how that could happen, but they actually arrested people at USC, which are going to get mommy and daddy very upset because it costs a lot of money to get that at the University of Spoiled Children. And we know that from maybe they were demonstrating about the band not having horns. I don't know. But Johnson called for an end to pro-Palestinian protests, including, if necessary, using force in the National Guard. Here is Mike Johnson at the Columbia presser with Jewish students at Columbia. Cut number three.
So, thank you all for being here today. We have several members of Congress here, and we're here today at one of America's preeminent academic institutions on a very important day and a very important time. Throughout history, Columbia students have contributed to the great storybook of America's life and thought. Visionary American leaders like Alexander Hamilton and John Jay and the Jewish leader Gershom Scheiches knew the self-evident truth that was at the heart of this country at the heart of this university, and that is that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. They should not be infringed. The founders and the great leaders who had come through this institution in the past believed in religious liberty. They believed in democracy. They believed in morality and virtue and the dignity of every human person. They believed in the free exchange of ideas, and they detested mob rule. We are standing here right now on the steps of the Lowe Library. In this very building right behind us, Columbia University once awarded Winston Churchill an honorary degree, and it was Churchill who said, "It is manifestly right that Jews should have a national home where they may be reunited."
Speaker Johnson. He was joined by Representative Mike Lawler of New York. Cut number 14.
And every single one of you students that support Hamas are an absolute abomination. It is shameful, shameful, that you would support a terrorist organization that butchered and beheaded and burned innocent women, children, and babies. I went to Israel a month after the attack on October 7th, and I watched a 21-minute unedited video, raw footage of the attack. I watched exactly what Hamas did. And sadly here in America, we have students endorsing the butchering and brutality of a terrorist organization.
Go on with Representative Anthony D'Esposito, also from New York. Cut number 15.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. If you are a protester on this campus and you are proud that you've been endorsed by Hamas, you are part of the problem. When you cheer on the fact that you enjoy Hamas and Hezbollah, you are yourself part of the problem. Mr. Speaker, I am proud to join with you here today in calling for the immediate resignation of the President of Colombia. She has failed her duty. She is not keeping students safe. And we see on this campus the hate-filled speech that is carrying through this country.
Then finally, Representative Nicole Malliotakis also joined Speaker Johnson at Columbia. Cut number 13. I'm so proud of these Republicans for going into the heart of darkness, which is the pro-Hamas terrorist supporters on Columbia campus. Let's go to Malliotakis.
We just met with a group of students who told us that not only have they been bullied, but they've been, many of them, assaulted. They have been spat on. They have had to walk the halls of this campus to see swastikas painted. These are clear examples of anti-Semitism, and it's shocking to see that it's happening in the most diverse and welcoming city in America. It is truly outrageous, and it's clear that the president of this university cannot control the campus. She cannot and will not hold students who are doing these types of anti-Semitic activities accountable, and that she cannot keep the students who are of Jewish faith, who have paid a lot of money and have worked very hard to get to an Ivy League institution like this, that she cannot keep them safe. And that is why I join my colleagues in calling for her resignation.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu addressed the situation, not just at Columbia, but at Yale, at Harvard, at NYU, at the University of Michigan, at USC, at the University of Texas, all across the United States. The anti-Semites are coming out of the woodwork. And Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to it yesterday. Cut number one.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It's unconscionable. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned, and condemned unequivocally. But that's not what happened. The response of several university presidents was shameful. Now, fortunately, state, local, federal officials, many of them have responded differently, but there has to be more. More has to be done. It has to be done not only because they attack Israel. That's bad enough. Not only because they want to kill Jews wherever they are. That's bad enough. It's also, when you listen to them, it's also because they say not only death to Israel, death to the Jews, but death to America. And this tells us that there's an anti-Semitic surge here that has terrible consequences. We see this exponential rise of anti-Semitism throughout America and throughout Western societies as Israel tries to defend itself against genocidal terrorists. Genocidal terrorists who hide behind civilians. Yet it is Israel that is falsely accused of genocide. Israel that is falsely accused of starvation and all sundry war crimes. It's all one big libel. But that's not new. We've seen in history that anti-Semitic attacks were always preceded by vilification and slander, lies that were cast against the Jewish people that are unbelievable, yet people believed them. And what is important now is for all of us who are interested and cherish our values and our civilization, to stand up together and to say enough is enough. We have to stop anti-Semitism because anti-Semitism is the canary in the coal mine. It always precedes larger conflagrations that engulf the entire world. So I ask all of you, Jews and non-Jews alike, who are concerned with our common future and our common values, to do one thing. Stand up, Speak up. Be counted. Stop anti-Semitism now.
Good for the prime minister. And I want to let you know that Daniel Loeb, who's a Columbia graduate, has begun to reconsider whether hiring anyone from an Ivy League at his hedge fund makes sense. And I think this is the only way for, we have to decredential the Ivies. Now, I'm talking against my own university, Harvard, but it's lost its mind, too. They closed the doors of Harvard Yard, very rare, and still it filled up with anti-Semitic protests. Very hard to close off Harvard Yard. There are 1,000 ways into it. But the kids, if they were really kids, they're all freshmen. So they're stupid anyway because they're freshmen. But I think the answer is don't hire anyone from the Ivies. Don't hire anyone from USC. Don't hire anyone from Texas. Don't hire them as clerks at your law school, at your judges. If you're listening, go back through and make sure that you are not bringing in as a clerk anyone who participated in any anti-Semitic act. It ought to be disqualifying, and not just for now, for a long, long time, because kids are stupid. I was stupid when I was 18. I was stupid when I was 22. It took a long time to get unstupid. But when you get unstupid, you'll be very embarrassed over what you have been doing all these years. Nothing is as vile as anti-Semitism. Nothing. And if you're practicing it on a college campus, good luck getting a job. I'll be right back.
It's a mistake. It's a mistake. It's a mistake.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That terrible bump music is courtesy of producer Dwayne, non-producer Dwayne. I have no idea what that song is, but I asked him for a tech screw-up bump, and that's what he came up with. Because 2 days ago, we had Luke Smallbone lined up, ready to talk to Luke about the movie that is coming out, the Unsung Hero movie, tonight in some theaters over the weekend. Unsung Hero, great film. And Luke Smallbone, should you not know, should you live in a cave, one of the biggest Christian music artists with his brother in the For King and Country group. And For King and Country is huge success. They're from Australia. So I had Luke on the show, and then the, whatever we call it, the transponder died. And so Luke went away. So we redid it yesterday after the show, which explains why in the conversation with Luke, I referenced a tech failure. With that, let's roll the interview with Luke Smallbone about the movie Unsung Hero, which is debuting tonight in some theaters, but mostly tomorrow. Smallbone of course, For King and Country. Luke, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. We tried this earlier this week and had a technical fail. I'm glad it's working today. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me. And hey, technology sometimes wants to keep us down, man, but we just got to make sure we change our attitude. You know what I'm saying?
It made me want to ask you, you've played 1,000 shows, I would assume. How many times has something gone wrong right before the curtain goes up?
All right. So here's a story for you. You'll like this. So we're last Christmas, we're on our Christmas show. And we have this stage to where we would go to the middle of the arena and we would come up from the middle of the stage. All right. And we'd kind of surprise you, walk up, and that's where the show starts. And nobody knows. We would crawl under the stage. And so nobody would know. It was kind of surprising, all sorts of stuff. So we get out there, and 5 seconds before we're meant to walk up and surprise people, like, hey, how did we get here? We crawl under the stage. You didn't see that coming, that type of thing. The microphones just weren't on at all. And so with this, there's a crescendo of, and you know, you wait, the lights are coming down and we don't get up because our mics aren't working. And literally we were held underneath the stage for 10 minutes because our mics wouldn't work. So
I think your producer must be named Dwayne. That's all the producer's fault. It's always the producer's fault. That's actually, okay, Luke, talk to me a little bit about Unsung Heroes, because movie projects are sometimes a success for singer-songwriters who are very successful, sometimes they're not. Tell me about Unsung Heroes.
Yeah. So we're originally born in Australia. Hopefully you can still tell. My dad was a concert promoter in Australia. A little bit. That's good. Yeah, you Americans have jacked up my accent, so thanks for that. But anyway, born in Australia. My dad was a concert promoter back there. And on one particular tour that he brought back to Australia, the tour didn't go very well, and we lost everything that we had as a family. We lost the house. We lost the car. We lost the life savings. And so my dad was looking for a fresh start for his career. And he got a job offer in Nashville, Tennessee. And he thought it would be a good idea to move his six kids and his wife, who was 6 months pregnant at the time. And that's exactly what we did. We moved. But as soon as we arrived, my dad lost that job. And so we were stranded on the other side of the world. No friends, no family. We were sleeping on beds made out of clothes. Didn't have any way for our little sister to be born in a hospital. Didn't have a car. Weren't always quite sure where the next meal was going to come from. So we really struggled as a family. And I've told that story from stage, actually, for about the last 11 or 12 years, and had a lot of people come up and say, Luke, you should write a book. And the truth is, Joel and I were homeschooled, so we don't read or write very well. And, I'm just kidding. And so we thought maybe we could make a movie instead. And the heartbeat of this film is that I believe in family. I think the family is more important today than it ever has been in the history of the world. But yet we don't value it as such. And Mother Teresa says it best, in my humble opinion. I think there's a lot of people that are trying to change the world, but we think it's got to take place with a microphone. We think it's got to take place with a platform or a stage. And Mother Teresa says, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family.
You know, Luke Smallbone, every time I go to concerts, I go to concerts for people of my generation, like Jackson Browne. His politics are terrible. His music is wonderful. Yeah. Joan Baez, greatest voice in the business. Her politics are terrible. Her voice is wonderful. But whenever I see any musician, I think behind that musician is a mom who said it's okay to practice in the garage. There's a dad who bought the drum set. I'm sure that's true because your dad was a producer, but did anyone ever say to you, this is not really an economically sound way to go given what your dad's experience was?
So I go and ask my my wife's father for her hand in marriage, and one of the great topics of conversation was, how are you actually going to provide for my daughter? And so we had this back and forth, and it was, and honestly, I felt loved by it, and could tell obviously loved his daughter because there was discussions, and I just literally this was the only appeal that I had there. I was like, hey man, I've given like 4 or 5 years of my life to just focusing on music. I've just got to see it through. And he goes, works for me. All right, I get that. And so yeah, I mean, you're gonna have some hard conversations, but it does take. What does it say? They say it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a city and a nation and for people to get a part of you as an artist. And then more importantly, in this instance, to make a movie. Movies are incredibly complicated. I mean, the film business is, it's like gambling. It's insane. But I believe in this. I believe in this message. I believe in this movie. You know, some of the ratings and the test scores that we've got are, you know, they're extraordinary. So we're onto something. But yeah, it's difficult to get the word out. And you're playing with the big boys when you're playing with Hollywood.
But you've got Lionsgate on your side, which is, to me, when there are movies with a Christian theme, either they have distribution or they don't. You do. So that's, you're out of the starting gate. Well, yeah. When does Unsung Heroes debut, and how do you feel about the number of theaters it's opening in?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have a lot of good news in this regard because you're right. We've partnered with some wonderful people. But the film comes out April the 26th, and we're calling it Family Day. It's the film business is fascinating because with music, you release a song, you release an album, you basically got 2 years to prove if it's any good. A film, you have 72 hours. And so, everything's kind of hinged on the release of this film, this weekend. And so, yeah, we're excited about it. It is a complicated thing to make a movie. But we're thrilled with where it's going, and we're up against, this is fascinating. You'll probably find this interesting. Never in the history of filmmaking has a film potentially been the number one film in America. Because you got Marvel, who's going to do $70, $80 million. And, you know, for the most part, these films that we make, you know, you're not going to be able to make necessarily an opening like that. But this weekend, there's like a parting of the Red Sea. There's only one other film, and it's actually a rated R raunchy film. So we've got family on our side, and we've got a rated R raunchy film on the other side. And it's the people saying, hey, this is the first time in the history of filmmaking that a Christian film, a faith-based film, could be the number one film in America. And so that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, audience, listen to that. Go this weekend. Go tomorrow on Friday. Go on Saturday. Go on Sunday. Put Unsung Heroes at the top. Luke, one last question. Did your family stay in Nashville? Yeah. Because back then you could probably buy a house for, you know, less than $100,000. Now it's a completely insane real estate market. Did they stay there?
We did. Yeah, we actually did. You know, some of the family left at different places. We had, you know, a sister went to L.A. or California for a little while. She came back, of course. Then somebody went to Atlanta for a while, Texas. But everybody has actually come back. And the truth is, the house that I grew up in is still the house that my parents live in, partially because of what you just said. It's just so expensive here now. It's unbelievable. Everybody's coming. You know, they seem to come to Tennessee. So it's crazy.
Yeah,
so
it was run by John Cooper, one of my college buddies for a long time. He's a Democrat, but he's still okay. I look forward to Unsung Heroes. I will myself be out at the theater this weekend. Luke, thanks for trying to land the plane the second time we hit it. And I appreciate your time very much. Good luck this weekend. I know you wait on Friday night to see what those box office numbers are like, and I'm sure they're going to be great. Unsung Heroes. In a theater near you this weekend. Go out and make it number one. Thank you, Luke.
All right, thanks. You appreciate it.
Charisma in buckets. I had not talked with Luke Smallbone before. 2 days ago when takeoff number one blew up on the launch pad because of technical difficulties. But that worked really well. And it's not just because he has black glasses. You might be tempted to think that. I like charisma in buckets, and I'm sure the movie will be a success. But get out and support Unsung Heroes this weekend. Take your family, especially if you've got a musician in the family. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway on this Thursday morning. As I was discussing in segment one of the show, Speaker Mike Johnson and a delegation of Republicans from Congress went to Columbia's campus yesterday. They confronted the anti-Semites face to face. That's the way to do it. Call them out. Police arrest people who get violent. They're doing that at USC, at the University of Texas. They're doing it at NYU. They should do it wherever the anti-Semites gather and assault people. Assault, remember, is imminent fear of an unpermitted touching. And it is a felony in almost everywhere. You can't put people in fear of getting hit without committing assault. Battery is the actual physical touch. Both occur in many of these places. Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida had a message, which I wish every governor and every college president, like Ben Sasse, president of the University of Florida, has adopted. But here's Ron DeSantis at a presser yesterday, cut number two. Do we not have the sound for Governor DeSantis? All right, dump Governor DeSantis, and let's go instead to Governor Shapiro of Pennsylvania, cut number 18.
Well, I think we need to restore some order on campuses at Columbia and across this country. Certainly, students and others have a right to peacefully protest in adherence with university policy and the laws of the city and the states they're in. I think what's important is that we can't allow peaceful protest about a disagreement on policy happening in the Middle East to be an excuse for anti-Semitism or Islamophobia on these campuses. We can't allow it to be an excuse that puts certain students at risk to be able to go to classes safely or to be able to worship safely. And universities have a responsibility to ensure the safety and well-being of their students and to make sure that the rules of the university are being followed. What I see from afar,
that's almost good. It is no longer necessary to say and in Islamophobia, because there is no Islamophobia currently on campuses. So I know that that is de rigueur for people who don't want to offend their Muslim American population. And I get that. But that's not the problem right now. The problem is anti-Semitism, not Islamophobia. Anti-Semitism is the problem. And we ought to be clear about that. Listen to Jonah Goldberg last night getting cut off on a CNN panel with Lulu Garcia Navarro, cut number four.
I think the anti-Semitism stuff, particularly Passover, is a big issue. It's a legitimate issue to talk about. It's a serious issue. And I think there's a lot of anti-Semitic stuff going on out there. But when you're saying you're Hamas, when you're praising Hamas, when you're praising Hezbollah, when you're saying you're going to globalize the Intifada.
Excuse me. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I'm going to finish my point.
It means you're pro-terrorist. If you are celebrating Hamas, you're a pro-terrorist.
I'm not disputing that. What I'm saying is there are selective quotes that are being taken, often not from students themselves. In the encampments in Columbia, they have said this. There are Jewish students who are actually part of this. And they are being used to say, wait, let me finish my point. No,
so,
that's
but,
true. But just would say more broadly, when people are calling for action, like Representative Gottheimer, what are they actually calling for? You've already had
go on. If the people in those encampments, whether they're Columbia students or not, if the university can clear them from that encampment, then that is something the university can do.
But they've already put, let me just say how we got here. Columbia chose to bring police to clear the encampment that inflamed the situation to where now you're seeing these protests spread to Yale, to New York University, and beyond. Many people have said that the action of bringing police into a group of people who are already feeling that they are sort of representative of the oppressed, who are inspired by what happened with George Floyd in 2020 and seeing what is happening in Gaza, that has only really acted as a catalyst here. And so I wonder at the wisdom of bringing in the armed police into what is essentially a university campus.
The wisdom of having a double standard that says it's okay to shout hateful pro-terrorist things at Jews, but
no one is endorsing that.
A lot of people are endorsing that. A lot of people aren't condemning it. Yeah, a lot of people aren't condemning it. And I agree with you. Universities and the Democratic Party and the left have a huge problem trying to figure out how to cut this Gordian knot that they've created for themselves. But that doesn't mean I have to sort of condone or not call out. I got a lot of scars from calling out horrible statements on the right over the last 10 years. I call out anti-Semitism and bigotry all the time on the right.
Of course.
I don't hear a lot of that from sort of squad adjacent type people calling out this stuff on the left.
All right, good Jonah. He's absolutely right. There is a double standard here. He got cut off a couple of times and he kept his cool. Jonah's a pro. And you have to listen to idiocy. That was idiotic, by the way. It was idiotic that police inflamed the Columbia situation and therefore it spread to NYU and Yale. How exactly does that happen? I'll tell you how it happens. It's not spreading from Columbia. It is inchoate on every campus among a small group of people who then get the dummies to sit with them in a tent and scream what they do not understand to be anti-Semitic cliches such as from the river to the sea. They do not understand anti-Semitism. Most of them are ignorant. I'll bet you. Now, I've never, ever, ever heard of Lula. Don't know who she is. Lulu Garcia Navarro. Never heard of her. My guess is she doesn't know a lick about the British mandate. Not one year of it. But she's welcome to come on and prove me wrong anytime. Last night, not going to win the spelling bee at CNN last night. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Noah Rothman, senior editor at the National Review. Good morning, Noah. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Noah, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Hit it, Adam.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
But you are being subjected to it this morning, Noah. Do you know anything about how Israel came to be?
In 1948?
Well, I know.
Thousands
thousands
of years ago.
No, I'm talking about basically from 1918 to 1948.
The insurrections in the 20s and in the 1930s, the efforts to establish Zionism and the Balfour Declaration. And that's about it. It was a cursory review.
Okay, here's my cursory review, because I think the problem on campuses is anti-Semitism mixed with ignorance. The Ottoman Empire ruled all of what is now modern-day Israel, as well as modern-day West Bank Palestine or the occupied territories, if you happen to be a leftist, as well as Jordan, as well as Egypt, for hundreds of years until the after World War I, because Turkey got on the wrong side of the Allies. And so the Allies took over, the League of Nations took over. I'm sorry, I'm choking here a little bit. And then they gave the control of the former Ottoman territories, all of which were controlled out of Istanbul, Constantinople in the old days, to the League of Nations, who gave it to Great Britain, which ran the British Mandate. And the British Mandate was there from 1918 to 1948. So the Israelis who moved there were a lot of indigenous Jews there, along as well as some indigenous Palestinians. So what did they do? They split it. And so they're both origin. They're both Israel is the original anti-colonial experiment. I just think these kids are stupid, Noah.
That's an interesting way to put it. Yeah, I mean, the supposition that these people are uneducated was advanced by a video that made the rounds yesterday, which I found illustrative of the problem. One of these young protesters was asked, you know, why are we protesting here? And kind of turned to her companion and was asked, you know, what is NYU doing exactly that we're protesting? And the other person next to her didn't have an answer and said, I wish we were more better educated, is what she said. I wish we were more educated, illustrating how uneducated they are, both in substance and speech. It was illustrative of the broader problem here, which is that these people are profoundly well educated. They are educated in what the subjects their professorate wants them to know, which amounts to a miseducation. It's something I wrote about in National Review the other day, is why is it that these students, only after they experience the belated consequences for their actions, either administratively through the school or via police, only then do the professors rush into the breach that this vanguard has opened and illustrate that all the while the people who are orchestrating this thing were the professors, were the individuals who they trusted to educate them properly, because this is all an exercise of power and a top-down exercise of power. The students are not protesting against the powers that be. They're the tools of the powers that be. And it's all and only in pursuit of more power for the already powerful people who occupy positions of authority in these august institutions of higher learning that command immense influence in our society, but not sufficient.
No, I want to take you back even further, because I don't think it's just the professors, though I've been on a faculty of a law school for, I don't know, 1996. You do the math. It's been a long time. Many, many smart people, but they're pretty ignorant about things outside of their specialty. They might teach contracts law. They might teach torts, but they don't know anything about world history. World history used to be offered in the ninth grade. Did you ever take a world history course?
Yeah, sure. In high school and undergrad. And then I went to get a grad degree.
What year did you get your first?
My high school?
Yeah.
98. I think it was.
But I mean, was it freshman year?
No, not in freshman year. The AP courses, I began in AP courses in history. I wasn't the greatest high school student, but history was my subject. And I started taking AP classes in, I think, junior year, which would have been 98.
That is normal. AP in junior is normal. But I think it's all crashed and burned in public schools. I'm a Catholic school grad, so I got a pretty good dose of world history, and I took Latin and Greek. Where did you go to school?
I went to a very good public high school where I also took Latin and learned Russian history and what have you. But it was a public high school in New Jersey. One thing I thought my history education was actually quite good, especially in international affairs. Where I thought it fell flat, and I was only very resentful of it later on in my career, was in the study of 19th century history in the United States. Roughly nothing happened between TR's presidency and Reconstruction. And only when I started reading, you know, taking an autodidactic look at this period, did I find it was profoundly, rambunctious and rich and deep and very interesting. And I was a little regretful of the education that I didn't receive in that period of history throughout both my high school and college education. But when it comes to world history,
I had the same,
especially
experience.
European history, they did a pretty good job.
But when we took European history, I am regretful of the fact we learned European history like Bismarck did this and Napoleon did that, separated by many decades, of course. But we didn't learn the history of the Jews. We didn't learn about the pogroms. We did not learn about the Pale. We did not learn about why Jews came to the United States in the 19th century, why they came in the 20th century, and why Israel was set up. We never learned any of that stuff. And I would just bet a dollar to a donut that if any of these kids knew anything about anything, they would not join. Because I do think you're right. Professors fill a void, and they fill a void with babble. It's absolute academic babble. And I didn't get babble in undergrad. I went to school in the 70s. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's not that they don't know history. It's that they know a very selective version of history, which is designed to animate these kind of protests. It's designed to inculcate in the student body a sense of revolutionary zeal to effect a grand historical reversal for the offenses and the sins of the forefathers. It is not a study of history of how a people came to be. It is a study of how a series of oppressive efforts by by structural powers, most of them, you know, the result of capitalist enterprise, and how they exerted influence unduly and unfairly, and why a reversal of those conditions is valuable. It's the underpinning of modern social justice, which essentially views all of mankind as a series of tribes. And some of them are better off than others. And those who are better off than others are benefiting from undeserved gains. And it's incumbent on us to restore the historical balance by meting out cosmic justice to those tribes that have benefited unduly. It is a tribal vision of history that has less affection for and desire to support its theory on events than it does on identity.
Well, no, I agree with all that, but I want to add a layer. Which is beneath that teaching is Adam Smith's invisible hand. People who teach that are teaching it to benefit themselves and make themselves more valuable to society and make more money. At the bottom of everything is money and power, and they usually go together. And the powerless academics want to make more money and they want power, so they come up with harebrained schemes and they write harebrained books and they peddle it to harebrained students so as to make money and to get power and influence. And it's working. I don't know what to do. I want to give you the last minute. What's your solution for campuses, Noah?
I would love to see a less Marxian vision of history, as though there's this historic arc, laws of history, all this sort of nonsense that is derivative of a Bolshevist Marxian view of the historical dialectic. Whereas your approach, which is sort of more organic and entropic and uncontrolled, that's the version of history that I learned. I think it's the version of history that you learned. And it gives us a sense, not of power necessarily, but of duty and responsibility to continue and maintain the traditions that have led somehow, just by virtue of experimentation and a lot of luck, towards the social compact that we have now, which is predicated, again, on these organic relationships towards the state and a respectful view of the state as being something less than omniscient. These students have a view of themselves as being the arbiters of a moral conception of how history should unfold. And they've therefore been miseducated in their relative ability to influence events. They think of themselves as much more powerful and much more influential than they are. They need a little bit less hubris and more more wonder and awe at the roles that they play. I think a little bit of humility would go a long way.
Don't you think? It's such a waste. It's such a waste of 4 years. They ought to be taking a common core that would open the world to them on how we actually got here to this place and this time, how they got there individually and how the country got here. It's such a waste of time and effort by dummies talking stupid things. But not Noah Rothman. He's a smart guy, and he's here every week. Thank you, Noah. Follow him on Twitter at Noah Rothman on X, I should say. And I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned.
You got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. I really do believe our problem on campuses is ignorance. Not just of the students, many of the professors, certainly a lot of the administrators are ignorant. And by ignorant, that doesn't mean stupid. They're very smart people. There's a difference between ignorant and stupid. Some people cannot learn. They have low ability to learn. Some people can learn a lot and they go deep. I'm a pretty smart guy, but I don't know anything about physics. And I barely got out of physics in high school because it didn't make sense to me. And thank you, Sister Aloysius in the sky, because you put me on your back and got me through geometry, which made not a lick of sense to me. I know that's going to surprise many of you. But I have always gotten history, and I've always read widely. I went and pulled a book that I read in 1983 when it came out, called Redemption of the Unwanted by Abram Shakar. He was the founding president of Brandeis University, and it's the history of what happened to the Jews after they got out of the camps, because not a lot of them survived the camps. And Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I watched a wonderful movie last night called A Bag of Marbles, which is the true story of a family in Paris. Father was a barber. Three older boys were understudies. Two young boys got separated. They somehow survived the Holocaust and the Nazis. And it's a harrowing movie, and it's just something that they ought to make people watch, because history doesn't begin with World War II, and Israel does not begin with World War II. Israel is not a response to the Holocaust. Israel is a response to Theodor Herzl in the 19th century, coming up with the idea that Jews are never going to make it anywhere. They eventually get thrown out of everywhere or killed everywhere or beaten and dispossessed everywhere. And that's based on, of course, the Jews were in the Middle East for thousands of years until the Romans destroyed the Second Temple and dispersed the Jewish people everywhere around the world. A lot of them stayed in the Middle East. There was, I think, a quarter, one out of four people who were living in Baghdad in 1947 were Jewish. But the Jews went everywhere in the world, and when they got to Eastern Europe, primarily in the Pale of Russia, they were ordered to live there, and they did. They were allowed to live in the city of Odessa, and they lived throughout Poland in various communities. And often the locals would decide to have a pogrom, and they would beat up and often kill dozens of Jews in just kind of a ritual celebration of not being Jewish. I don't know, but in any event, Herzl came up with the idea, we got to have the Congress of Zionists, and let's argue about where we're going to go, because we can't stay here. And Zionism eventually persuaded the British government to issue the Balfour Declaration, which said the Jews are entitled to a homeland. That's about it. That's all it says. World War I comes along. The Ottoman Empire, which dates back hundreds of years, controlled all of the Middle East, all of modern-day Israel, all of modern-day Jordan, all of modern-day Egypt, all of modern-day Syria, all of modern-day Lebanon. It was all part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans picked the wrong side in World War I. They went with the Germans. So when they lost, the Allies, under the guise of the League of Nations, took over the Middle East. And they assigned to Great Britain, they assigned other things to France, but they assigned to Great Britain the land that used to be Ottoman Empire that would then become what was known as the British Mandate. And the Brits spent forever doing a terrible job trying to figure out how to split up the British Mandate into Arab and into Jewish segments. There were lots of Jews in Israel at the in modern day Israel at the end of World War I. And more came in the 30 years before World War II, and more came as the Holocaust approached and the Nazis arrived, and then survivors came to afterward, and then the Arabs kicked all the Jews out of every Arab country, and they all went to Israel. So Israel is an organic anti-colonial experiment. It was a colony of the Ottomans, then it was a colony of the Brits, and then it became a colony of the Jews, and then the Jews declared independence, and the UN recognized them, and they became a state. And then the Arab countries around them tried to immediately push them into the sea and were defeated by David Ben-Gurion and the IDF, and Israel has stood proudly since then. I will bet you not one in a thousand students can come close to that little bit of concentrated history about Israel. They don't know anything, because high schools have failed, because colleges have failed, because Common Core curriculums have not included the history of the Middle East. And if nothing else, before you say anything about the Middle East, at least know that much so you're not stone cold stupid. Start with the Ottomans. All right, I'm not asking you to go back to the beginning of time. Maybe start with the Romans in 70 AD, but then go to the Ottomans and figure it out, because don't be a stupid college kid or one of their stupid professors. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce the audience to Jonathan Tobin. I have been reading Jonathan for probably 30 years, and then I had the great honor of being his guest on his wonderful podcast, Top Story, which I would encourage all of you to add to your download list and rate and rank and spread the word about. Jonathan, welcome. It's great to have you on our Home and Away series.
Well, thanks so much, you. It was a pleasure having you on, and it's an honor for me to be on your show.
Now, Jonathan, your alma mater, King's College, as it was originally known, is now Columbia, and it's in meltdown freefall. I would like to begin with an unusual question. How was your experience at Columbia, and what years were you there?
I was there in the late 1970s. My experience was interesting. That was during the era of the Soviet Jewry movement. And honestly, it was dominated, you know, it was a school that was dominated by leftists and leftist teachers and liberal teachers. But I think there was a real difference. I never felt endangered as a Jew on campus. The left was not obsessed with denying the rights of the Jews. They were much more interested in, you know, sort of trashing the West and the United States in general. But I think it was also an era in which even when you had, as I can recall, at Columbia College, and that was actually in a time when it wasn't co-ed, as Columbia is now, you could have in the contemporary civilization course, which is the mandatory liberal great books courses that one had to take there and still has to take when people are showing up for class, I guess. We had plenty of leftist teachers who introduced us to, ideas and that I found quite toxic, like Herbert. I can recall reading Herbert Marcuse's Critique of Pure Tolerance, which is which I was gobsmacked by it as a kid reading this great intellectual defense of tyranny, of suppressing free speech. And, I challenged my teacher about it. But that was an era in which you can have an argument with teachers about things like this. And you can get away with it and be a young conservative, be a Zionist, be a someone who cared about Soviet Jewry. And, I didn't feel as if I was going to be penalized for it. So that was a big difference.
And I want to pick up there. I'm a little bit older than you. Harvard in the mid 70s was a very intellectually robust place where you could be a conservative. I arrived out of parochial schools and I had a good education and I knew what I believed and I could argue with people. But there were also faculty members like Harvey Mansfield with whom I could identify politically and intellectually and learn from. But I also took Judith Sklar, who was a woman of the left, and it was a robust discussion. Did Columbia still have the common core, the hardcore, everybody's got to know where the West came from because the West is a good thing? Did they still have that when you went there?
Oh, for sure. In fact, it has it in some form today. I think the core curriculum has been, I could be canceled for saying it, watered down. It's much more diverse. sort of put air quotes around diverse. But the great books courses are still there. You still have to take art humanities and music humanities. And it's still part of the liberal education that one is supposed to get. I had it in its undiluted form as it was originally intended. And quite frankly, I learned a lot. And, I came from a public school on Long Island, and I considered myself very well read, but I had a lot to learn.
So, Jonathan, if we got these students, or your contemporary now at Columbia, who are on the quad, if we got them together in a quiet place and we posed these questions to them. Number one, what did the Romans do in 70 AD? Number two, what is the Pale? Number three, what is the Ottoman Empire? Number four, what is the British Mandate? And number five, what is the original anti-colonial experiment in the Middle East? Do you think they could answer any of those? And if so, how many of them do you think they could answer?
I would bet based on my encounters with young people, even smart, educated young people, that most of them would get none of those right, unless somehow they were history majors of that era, you know, of 20th century history majors. In general, knowledge of history in this country is abysmal. That's just as true among the educated elites who are not taught history and know very little. I mean, it's a cliche that the people chanting from the river to the sea, which is an eliminationist slogan, cannot identify which, you know, those two bodies of water. It's a cliche that most of them don't know why they're protesting against Israel, why they're protesting against their schools, quote unquote, connections with Israel. But the fact is, the core of all of this has really very little, if anything, to do with what Israel is doing, and nothing to do with history. It has to do with what has happened to the American educational system in the last few decades, and especially in the last couple, in which toxic ideas like critical race theory and intersectionality that had its roots in those neo-Marxist and Marxist ideas that I referenced earlier when I talked about Herbert Marcuse and his critique of pure tolerance, and which is a screed, a very intellectual screed about why free speech should not be tolerated, that the intellectual should tell everybody what to think and that's it. As people who discuss American politics, critical race theory and intersectionality, you know, with what happened after the Black Lives Matter riots of 2020, that, you know, for many people, that's just some Republican talking point, conservative cliches. But they explain what is happening at our universities today, because as I've been writing about for a few years, and others have as well, these theories, which divide us all in this permanent race war between black and white, between quote unquote victim, you know, everybody's either a victim or an oppressor, and the world is divided. You are either one or the other. And all victims are alike, all oppressors are alike. They're all part of the same struggle. This formulation, which is terrible for America, is dividing us along racial lines when we don't need to be divided, grants a permission slip to anti-Semitism because it defines Jews and the state of Israel as white oppressors. And that is why all these kids are chanting Free Palestine and from the river to the sea, because they think this is part of the racial conflict. They think this is part of why it is analogous to the struggle for civil rights in the United States. They don't understand that the Jews are the indigenous people of the land of Israel. They don't know that Jews have rights there. They don't know that the majority of Israeli Jews are themselves people of color by the definitions of the American left. They don't know that the conflict between Jews and Arabs in that country, in that small country in the Middle East, is not a racial conflict. Jews and Arabs are more or less the same race. Jews are diverse. They're black. They're white. They're brown. Arabs can be the same too. So this is nothing to do with what they think it has to do with, and that's why they're chanting these. That's why they have in what Niall Ferguson called the treason of the intellectuals. This is a top-driven movement. This is not coming from the working class. This is not coming from supposedly ignorant people. These are supposedly smart people who have been conned by leftist Marxist intellectuals into believing that Israel is a racist state, that the Jews are oppressors, and that they're committing genocide against the Palestinians, which is not the case. It's a big lie. And that's why these people have become functional anti-Semites, whether they understand it or not.
Jonathan, we have arrived at the same place by very diverse paths. I'm the Irish Catholic kid from Ohio, went to parochial school. You're the Jewish kid from Long Island who went to public school. You went to Columbia. I went to Harvard. But we got smart, and nobody cared what we thought until we were, 30 years old and we actually knew something. But it requires a lot of learning. It requires serious history. They don't even know. These kids don't even know that Israel is the original successful anti-colonial state. So after World War II, Many, many former colonies achieved liberation, achieved independence. Most of them failed miserably and ended up as either failed states or partially failed states, and they continue to fail. Israel started out as a partition state that the UN set up, and it has succeeded beyond its wildest dreams, but it's the original anti-colonial experiment. They don't know this. And so, Jonathan, I'm going to put you on the spot. How do we fix this problem of America becoming stupid?
Well, for me, I mean, there are lots of ways to attack this issue and to think about it. For me, it all boils down to this long march of the progressives through our institutions that have made these toxic ideas and myths pervasive and not just, you know, something that to be discussed. They're the new orthodoxy. It's related to the woke catechism of diversity, equity, and inclusion that, you know, to which everybody in academia and then the corporate world and now under Joe Biden, the federal government, all pledge allegiance to. That has to be rolled back. That is the answer for America. That is, for me, the, you know, there are lots of issues that are important. But the most important issue is this battle for Western civilization, in which we have to defend our values, and that all these things that come together, whether it was the New York Times 1619 Project, critical race theory, they all point us towards this terrible divide. And as always, throughout the history of the West, the Jews are the canaries in the coal mine. The
hold on to that thought.
Open
we're going to take a break for about 30 seconds. I'm going to come back and talk about Christopher Rufo and Herbert Marcuse with Jonathan Tobin. Do go and find Top Story. You can find it at iTunes, Spotify, wherever there are podcasts. Go and find the Jewish News Syndicate. What is the URL, Jonathan? JNS.org?
JNS.org.
Yeah, JNS.org. Get smart about all things Jewish, but also get smart about all things American. They're kind of intertwined. And come back after the break on the radio show. You can pick up this next segment on my podcast today. But stay tuned. We got to go to a break because we are not NPR. We are not subsidized by the government. We have to let you listen to some sponsors. Stay with us. I'll be back with Jonathan Tobin on the other side.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show are brought to you in part by Key City Capital.
Welcome back, America. I'm continuing my conversation with Jonathan Tobin. You did not hear this part on the radio. If you listened this morning, this part was during the commercial break. It's only 4 or 5 minutes. Jonathan, Christopher Rufo was on my program before 10-7, and he laid out, and I was gobsmacked, is the word you used earlier. I was gobsmacked by his intellectual history of the left, which begins with the man you mentioned, Marcuse, and goes through Angela Davis, and he traces it out in the long march through the institutions. I've always kind of laughed at that because it was so stupid. It never, ever worked in history. Wherever it was tried, it ended up in tears and blood and slaughter. But it's undeniable. It worked. Herbert Marcuse won. Now the question becomes how to reverse that. And I look at every college president who shows up in front of Congress. And the thing is, there isn't one conservative among them, not one even rigorous intellectual, I think. What do you think?
No, I agree that they're all bureaucrats. They're all basically woke commissars. Throughout every certainly institution of higher learning in this country, you know, these woke commissars who enforce the diversity, equity, inclusion catechism control hiring. They control admissions, and they control the administrations now. And very few of them are actual scholars. But you know, you ask the key question: how do we roll this back? What do we do? You know, Chris Rufo's book is essential, really essential reading, because it traces exactly how it started and how we got to this point. You know, I think the answer is, as much as we conservatives like to be federalists, we need a strong federal government, which has a Department of Justice that will enforce laws against, racial discrimination, that will roll back this woke tide, that will enforce the laws against, that ban anti-Semitism. We have to use Title VI of the Civil Rights Act to defund all of these institutions, big institutions. Now, what can we do to Harvard? I mean, Harvard's got this massive endowment. They're one of the few things, institutions that could exist without federal funding. But this is about more than just Harvard, more than just Columbia or Yale or Princeton. This is about the entire educational system, our entire culture. You know, when you talk about, you know, pop culture, the late night talk shows, it pervades everything. And, you know, it is only by understanding how this ideology took over our culture and took over education, took over corporate and the federal government. Can you understand how the worst mass slaughter of Jews, the greatest mass slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust, incredible, unspeakable atrocities that happened on October 7th when Hamas attacked 22 communities and a music festival in southern Israel, that instead of that creating support for Israel, that generated a massive surge in anti-Semitism as Israel sought to defend itself against these criminals, against these mass murderers. You can only understand that by looking at the world through the prism of these leftist toxic ideas that have become the new orthodoxy, that are now mainstreamed in places like the New York Times and the Washington Post and MSNBC. That's where we have to fight this. That's why
you know,
we have to roll
what's
it
funny,
all
we
back.
Got to come back from break, Jonathan. You just mentioned two of my employers present, Washington Post and past MSNBC. And I got to tell you, in both places, there are some sane people, but they're gradually leaving and being silenced. Part of that is the Trump effect, which is unfortunately clouding the vision of many people who ought to be in this fray. I'll be right back with Jonathan Tobin for part three of our conversation. Don't forget, his podcast is Top Story at iTunes. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. My guest is Jonathan Tobin. John, I mentioned earlier I had come out of the parochial school system, but the parochial school system that was doing penance for a Roman Catholic history that had quite a lot of anti-Semitism in it. And so I ended up reading books like The Redemption of the Unwanted by Abram Sakar, who is the founding president of Brandeis University, and other books that made me aware of the historical evil of anti-Semitism and how it got into the water. And now I think we really need a second education system in America. And my proposals are very simple. One, no federal funding if you've got an endowment over $10 billion. And two, no federal funding at the K through 12 level for any state that does not have school choice as a robust option, because we just have to start over. I don't know that we can rebuild public education. I'm that pessimistic. Are you with me or think I'm overdoing it there?
No, that's music to my ears when you talk about school choice, which, you know, unfortunately, you know, we've struggled over the last three decades, as much as I think there's tremendous interest in from parents and certainly especially in the minority communities who are being victimized by failing public schools, the power of the teachers' unions, and now the power of the, you know, leftist intellectual ideas that have, as we've discussed, have taken over education. It doesn't work. We have to replace it. You know, it's very hard when you're talking about, say, elite institutions and parents who want to send their kids to, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, or MIT, wherever. You know, they think these are the, you know, the keys to success in life. But I think the brands have been, you know, degraded by this anti-Semitism and by, you know, how the leftists have taken over everything. I think we have to replace it. I think there's some ideas like Barry Weiss and Niall Ferguson's, you know, University of Austin, what the new college in Florida that Ron DeSantis and Chris Rufo have,
of course,
trying to establish, and Hillsdale, of course. But these are very small. There aren't that many options for sending kids to places where they can learn without this. So yes,
my last
we
question,
John,
this is a big question, so I want to give you 3 minutes to answer it. Have we lost? I mean, has the West lost? Because people sometimes, St. Augustine was writing the City of God as the barbarians came over the wall in Carthage. And I know that you can recover eventually, but do you think we've lost?
No, I refuse to believe that. And I refuse to believe that. I'll start with something that was taught to me when we started our conversation by my experience at Columbia, you know, decades ago during the Ice Age, when we were both young. Eugene Rice, who was then the chairman of the history department at Columbia University, said to me, I'll never forget it. He said, everything in history is inevitable. Nothing is inevitable. We have not lost. Plenty of times in history, things change. Alan Dershowitz, when I had him on my podcast, I asked him, how do we, this is so pervasive. And he said, well, in the 1950s, in order to get a job, you had to sign a McCarthyite pledge about communism. And nobody thought that would change. And within a few years, it was gone. Right now, you have to sign a DEI pledge to get a job in higher education. Perhaps if we fight hard enough, if we do not lose hope, if we keep our faith in what we believe in, we have above all, I say this to Jewish audiences, non-Jewish audiences, the thing that we need most is not necessarily even just the facts about the Middle East conflict or about critical race theory. What we need is courage. The courage to stand up for what we believe in, to stand up for Western civilization, to stand up for our faith. If we do, we can prevail. Without it, we're lost. We will give in to the counsels of despair. But we cannot despair. The stakes are too high. America is too important. It's important to the Jews because without American exceptionalism, the lives of the Jewish people in this country will not be worth a damn sooner or later. But also that's for everybody in this country. We need America to be exceptional. We have to fight for it. It won't be given to us. It's not supposed to be easy to defend what is most important. But we must do it. We must stand up for our values, for what's important, and against hate and against these toxic ideas that redefine words, redefine what is good and right. We cannot accept it. If you play by their rules, then you're lost. But we can't play by their rules. We have to stand up for what we believe in, the core values of Western civilization. And if we do, we'll defeat the anti-Semites. We'll defeat the people trying to divide America along racial lines.
Jonathan Tobin, I cannot improve on that. I'm not going to try to. Courage is the first virtue because it is the virtue on which all other virtues depend. And Jonathan, thank you for a good dollop of your time this morning. I remind everyone, John has a wonderful podcast. Jonathan has a wonderful podcast. It is called Top Story. It is available at iTunes, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Download it, rate it, tell people about it, and put JNS.org, the Jewish News Service, JNS.org, on your list of favorites. Visit it. Get smart every day. I look forward to talking to you again, Jonathan. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Harley. Thank you, General Ishima. Thank all of you for listening to today's Hugh Hewitt Show.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.